Hi, this is Brian, and welcome to the Zen and the Art of Manufacturing podcast, where we help manufacturers create calm and improve flow in the manufacturing environment. So today we have Jesse DeBriest. He's got a really long history of continuous improvement and actually really a varied background in a lot of different industries, like from being a helicopter pilot in the Army to being customer service, business development, manufacturing, and now doing continuous improvement at a bank. So welcome, Jesse.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
We are going to talk about the Kata problem-solving method. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this kind of a good place to start? Because my next question is going to be, well, how do you define what excellent is? You know?
Yeah,
it has to be measurable and objective, but then you have to know you got to define the process, right?
Yeah, name the process first, right? Do we understand what process we're talking about? And what's the scope of that? Second is, how do you measure it?
Yeah.
Speed, quality, safety, defects, right? Throughput, let's say it in a positive way, total throughput yield, the number of parts that come out the other side that are of good quality.
Yeah.
I mean, percent good quality. So there's lots of ways we can measure the process, which is the one we're going to focus on. What I've found, Brian, is that back to your point about we don't have to measure everything. If we pick the one critical measurable and we drive improvement of the process to achieve that, more often than not, the other metrics are going to get better too. And there's a great case study about this with Alcoa and Mr. O'Neill. Do you know this story?
So this is funny. We have a book club at Sensor Tracks. We read a book, we meet every Friday morning, and we're doing The Power of Habit, which has a chapter on Paul O'Neill in Alcoa. And that was one of the chapters we read for today.
It's a great story. I love to reference it all the time because he took that over the company over, the running in the red. A couple of weeks later, he had his first press conference and he said, we're going to make Alcoa world-class in safety, right? And it freaked everybody out. Like they ran to Wall Street and said, sell your stock. There's a hippie in charge of Alcoa. And he was dead serious about it and hyper-focused. So I think it's fascinating. So 3 years later, Alcoa is like in the black. And I think 5 years later after he started, they quintupled profits.
Mm-hmm.
Insane performance. So if we think about what would you have to do to make changes so the company is world-class in safety? So I think about, well, where are people getting injured? Somebody is doing something with eyes and hands that is risky and it's causing injuries. So that's where the improvement has to be. And if you get everybody focused on improving their process at that level to improve safety, quality is going to get better. Speed's going to get better. Employee engagement's going to get better. Everything's getting better. And it's proven. I run a simulation with my clients of the ball game where I make them do a job of the ball and then I tell them to go faster. And go faster and go faster. While I'm also measuring safety, quality, employee experience, and teamwork. But I don't talk about that as I'm driving the improvement. I just say, please go faster. At the end of the thing, safety is far better. Quality is far better. Just everything gets better. But I drove the improvement around one focus of the measurable, one measurable of the process. So back to the Kata.
Yeah.
Once we have our process defined that way, but so you ask a question, how do I define the challenge? Like, how do I know how to articulate the challenge? I think that's a great question. Yeah. So the challenge can be, first of all, framed based on where you are and where we need to go.
Yeah.
But the challenge should also be, I think, framed around what do we need to do to serve our customer well? And that could be a function of market competition. It could be a function of my customers currently requiring a certain level of performance, and I want to exceed that. So I set my challenge as something better than that, or we're not competitive. Competitor can deliver, make these products in 2 weeks, and it's taking us four. Mm-hmm. Well, there's, we need to get a challenge to 1 week so we can beat our competitors, right? But, so mm-hmm. it's not pulled out of the air. It should be articulated from some form of intelligence. And that's important, too, for leaders to say, when I give the challenge, I also should tell you why. Because we're not competitive. Because our customers are requiring us to improve, or they're going to take their business somewhere else. Whatever it is, right? And if the people understand why we're striving for that level of performance, then it brings meaning. I know why this is important and what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. All right. So now we frame the problem. We understand the process, how it's measured. We defined a challenge and why. Next thing then is to be really honest about where we are. Go measure what is in all its gory details. Just be honest. This is where it's like no assumptions, no feelings here. Just be honest and go measure it.
Yeah.
It's not a reflection of the people, right? And that's where people get really scared. It's like, oh, I don't want you to measure it because it would make me look bad. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, we're just trying to understand the current state of reality for this process. And once we agree to that, we measure it, we get good data. Now we have framed the problem between what is the current state and what excellent would be. But typically the gap between what is and the challenge is a really, really big gap.
Yeah.
And if we stop there, it's going to freak people out. Literally, the amygdala will come into play and we get scared and people get frozen and I don't know what to do. You know, it generates fear because the problem is too big. So we need to break it down. And that's where we ask the team then. Once we've done that work, we frame the problem, we ask the team, hey, what do you think would be a reasonable, feasible target for us to hit in the next 30 days? In the direction of the challenge. So we're going to define the target the same way we define the challenge in the current state. And let the team pick that, because now they've got some buy-in. It's like, yeah, you know, I think we could take 5 minutes out of that cycle time in the next 30 minutes. Sure, we can. We're going to see some waste. Good. Let's set that as the target. Now I've got a smaller problem to solve between my current state and the next target. The next step then would be to get the team to brainstorm about all the obstacles. What's preventing us from achieving that next target condition? And go crazy. Like, list all the things. If there's a moment for coaching with the team, there is to do the five why. Dig deep. Try to articulate the obstacle in its rawest, simplest form. Right? Get deeper. Go deeper. Now I've got a list of obstacles. And we ask the team, okay, based on all of these obstacles, which one should we work on first? Or two or three? But not all of them. Can't boil the whole ocean. Pick a couple. And the team gets to decide, let's go fix. Well, you know, I spend 10 minutes walking around for tools every day. Mm-hmm. Can we get the tools organized? Awesome. Let's go do that. So we put that up there. And so we take that obstacle. We say, this is the obstacle we're working on. Literally, the next question within the PDCA record, we create a little form for documenting actions and results, is simply, what's the next step? Well, what are we going to do today to start knocking out that obstacle? And we write that down and we make sure someone is the owner of that. And we say, okay, go do it. And we come back tomorrow in my team huddle through my daily management system. We've already framed the problem, so we don't need to spend a lot of time around the challenge or the current condition or the target. I'm going to go right to that action and say, we said we're going to move the tools. Did we? Yep. What did we expect to happen when we moved the tools? I'd save 10 minutes from walking around. Did we? Are we seeing an improvement? Right. Yes or no? Okay, good. We got that. Maybe we achieved the target just with that or not. Right? It's probably a series of things we have to do to remove a couple of obstacles in order to get to that next target condition. But the point is, when we get to that level of the problem-solving activity, we create this environment where it's like this agile-ish problem-solving environment where the team is deciding the next action that is relevant to the obstacle that's most important to achieve the next target. Mm-hmm. It creates autonomy. The team gets to decide and figure out what to do. It drives accountability and discipline because we're there every day. And this is a great place for the leader to show up in his gimbal walk to say, hey, what was the last experiment? What was the obstacle you're working on? What was the last step you took? What did you learn? And what's the next step you're going to take? And those are the coaching questions that I love, because I didn't tell you anything. I didn't tell you what to do. All I did was ask you the coaching questions, and that should drive good discipline and accountability for doing the work of making improvement. You know what else is cool about that, Brian, is we get out of this business as lean coaches of pushing tools onto teams. It never works. So we're going to do a 5S, and we're going to teach you 5S. We're going to do 5S. But if the team doesn't understand what we're trying to do, like what is the problem we're trying to solve, there's not going to be much buy-in. In this approach, I never said 5S, but the team said we should move the tools and get them organized. And it creates whole. And as they do more of that, then we can say, there's a methodology for this, guys. Would you like to know more about 5S? and you learn about there's like, yeah, let's just do a 5S because we could get a lot more done faster, right? Mm-hmm. And it creates pull for the support and help and learning. And that's magic. We create that environment where people are asking for help to solve these obstacles. Now we got a ripe environment for learning and real good process improvement work.
Yeah, that's cool. The thing that I always don't understand is when I talk to folks like you, and especially this, the way you're explaining it, it seems easy, but in reality, it's really not.
Yeah.
What are the obstacles that people struggle with to do this process that you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't expect everybody to have that embedded part of my DNA about process thinking. But the other thing too is, I think it's a result of our traditional leadership DNA. They have been so influenced by firefighting leadership behavior, getting in trouble when the process doesn't perform well. It's a lack of trust. It's a fear-based environment. And we are unpacking mm-hmm. that fear-based environment with these methods. And that's why it's hard, because people aren't sure that this new way of making improvements and the leader showing up asking these questions, that I'm not going to get in trouble, right? That you're just doing this for you. But over time, that's why I said consistency in the good leadership behavior. Every day, consistent, and you're asking the same coaching questions. No, by the way, when someone tries something, it doesn't work, we should celebrate. Say, awesome, thanks for trying that. We learned something. What are we going to try next? Good job, team. Mm-hmm. Appreciate you, because you're doing it. You're putting effort into this thing, and it's good. I also like to think that our employees that are working in the micropro, the value-creating employees, are the ones that suffer our bad processes and bad systems the most. And it's our responsibility as leaders to fix it. And you can't fix it by beating people over the head with a stick. So stop doing that and start behaving in a different way. And if you have been behaving like that as a leader, then it's going to take some time mm-hmm. to build that trust back, right? To get people to participate without skepticism. Yeah, that's what I think. The other maybe just too is that, we're comfortable in our status quo.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes I'm biased. I'm not biased. I believe in this stuff, and I try to implement it as much as I can, and we try to share it with our customers because I think it's really the right way to do things. I've been CEO of companies since I was 23. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just know the answer and you don't want to wait for everybody else to figure it out. And it's a really hard habit to break, right? It's way better if they figure it out on their own, but it's a hard habit to break.
It is a hard habit to break. I think if leaders that are struggling with that can just stop and reflect about what our real purpose is. Yeah, we want a company that's profitable and that kind of stuff, but what about the people? Are they just part of the machine, or do we love and respect and want to grow them?
Yeah.
And if that is our principle as leadership, then I'm going to be more interested in your growth and development mm-hmm. as a human being, more maybe than the output of this process right now, because I can't do it without you. Yeah, I know the answer, but I may not tell you the spirit of your success, right? Man, and what will that do to unpack fear and create a trust-based environment where now people are going to be working even harder to solve problems and striving for excellence in their processes? And hallelujah, because the leader doesn't need to be the big hero all the time anymore. That's impossible. We're not going to be successful if we just rely on the CEO as the answer man all the time. There's no possible way one leader can be able to know how to solve all these problems, right? Yeah, but it's a tough habit to break though, because that's what got us there. Maybe
it is. Yeah. But when you think about it, and this is the thing that I recognized, was once you start doing that and you trust your people more and you let them bring ideas to you and come up with problem solving, they try to solve the problems on their own, you get a lot more diverse input and better ideas that you could ever come up with on your own.
Amen. 100%. Yeah. And when the team gets good at it, they're going to learn to trust each other. Mm-hmm. And it's cooking good when a team is having a great debate around ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And then they end that debate with a decision and action around the best idea.
Yeah.
Oh man, that now we're problem solving in the best possible way. Yeah, that's good.
So the challenge, I mean, it almost sounds like the challenge kind of follows the mega, macro, micro hierarchy too, right? Like as a company, you were explaining, you know, maybe we're trying to get shorter lead times, improve quality, you know, improve customer experience. And then you're kind of breaking that down and bringing it to the different processes within the company.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So company I'm working with has that goal to improve speed, throughput. And we picked one product family because it represents a significant part of the value of the company. Mm-hmm. And we want it to go faster so we can create capacity because there's growth opportunities and we may not be able to realize those because we don't have capacity. So let's create capacity by improving the flow, the speed of the flow of the goods through the factory. So at an enterprise level, it's lead time, on-time delivery. At the process value stream level, it is like linear feet produced per day per week. Mm-hmm. At that one bonding machine, it's what is that machine cycle time? Because our we didn't do a formal value stream map, and there's a reason for that. But we said we think this press is probably one of our bottlenecks, so how can we improve its cycle time? And we built an improvement kata around that. And we know, just based on engineering and science, that the bonding process required a certain amount of time, right? We can't go faster than that we know of right now, based on the chemistry of the bonding process. So let's say that was 30 minutes. And the engineers say, the fastest you could do that is 30 minutes. Right now, it's taking us an hour and 15 from the machine. Time the machine goes up, the time the machine comes back down again.
Yeah.
So the challenge is 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Why? Because that's the capability of the machine in the process. Where are we now? It's an hour and 15. Pretty big gap. So what's the target? And the team picks something like, look, let's do it in 65 minutes. Mm-hmm. Let's take 10 minutes out of it. And it was all the low-hanging fruit things that they're working on. It's like, go back to basic 8 wastes, 5S, and basic problem solving. But they're already starting to think about future things, like what could we do to preheat the thing before it gets into the press, right? Because if we could preheat it, then maybe it wouldn't need to be in the press as long. We could actually make it faster than 30 minutes. So they're thinking about the process and how to make it better. And that's awesome. And really good. They're doing really good work.
Yeah.
But anyway, so back to your points, like how do we break it down from the mega, the macro, the micro? So the mega was enterprise. The macro is value stream and that cycle time. But there are also micro processes all around it that contribute to that throughput. And those are the things that we got to make better. We find better ways to do the work to go faster.
So in that particular example, you were talking about, I think when we had our initial conversations, like how a process behavior chart was something that was pretty helpful in that situation. Did I get that correct?
Yeah, there's a great book written on it by Mark Graben called, I should have thought about the name of the book before I said it. It'll come to me in a second. Having data on a Excel spreadsheet, like numbers on an Excel spreadsheet is like the basic form of that. And it's good, at least we're measuring it, you know, color it red and green, but there are numbers on a chart and I can't interpret that data into information. So I just take that data and plot it on a chart. So time on the horizontal axis and the measurable on the vertical, and I've got dots. Now I can do a really simple statistical analysis. So we don't need to freak out about that. We can ask the engineer to help us. It's not hard. We can calculate the mean. So I can see what the mean is. And then, you know, plus or minus 3 sigma. So I can see what the natural capability of that process is. And without that, the leaders will react to normal variation of the process and behave badly because of it. The book is called Measures of Success.
Okay.
Great book. And so here's an example. In a completely different environment, I'll just generalize for the sake of the parties. Let's say we had a process that we process a couple hundred products a month. And at the end, there's a quality check. And if we find a defect in any one of those products, it has to be fixed maybe, but we just measure it. So we had this process. It wasn't terribly sophisticated. We just said, if this product had any one defect in it, we're just going to count it as one. It may have had two or three. We're just going to count it as one. So how many of those things that we did produced had a defect in it? And we started plotting it on a chart. Mm-hmm. And 1 month, and it wasn't plotted yet. It was simply just numbers on a chart. And it was 30% 1 month. And it was like, and I was a new guy. I was like, 30%, that's pretty terrible. But no one reacted. Like, that was typical status quo. The next month we came in, it was 45%. And then leaders, what do you think the leader said then? Yeah, they said, what the hell's going on? Right? 45%.
Something, I hope, right?
What happened?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, sorry about this. And everyone was kind of upset about it. And we went back to work. And then next month we came back, it was 28%. And what was the leader's response then? So it went from 30 to 45 to 28.
Good job. You got it.
Okay, thanks for getting it back into control again, right? And then the next month we came back and maybe it's 20%. Well, y'all are doing really great work. You got another 8%. You're really nice. And then the next month we come back, it's 35%. He's like, what's going on? I thought you had that fixed. It was better. We were reacting to normal variation of the process. Now, if I plot it in a process behavior chart so I can see the mean, I can calculate what the normal distribution is. And if those dots are between the lines, we say you can't react to it. The process is behaving exactly as you've designed it. Mm-hmm. It's doing exactly what you've asked it to do based on how the system is designed. So 30 to 45 to 28 to 20 is normal variation, right? It's normal. Now, if we start making improvements to our process, and over time, I can see on that chart certain signals. And this is all part of the quality management thing. If there's a number of sequence of dots below the mean, I'm moving in the right trend. I know I've made a statistically significant improvement to the process. So I recalculate, I've got a new level of performance. And we keep driving that. And there are other signals to unpack there in that. But it's visual. With the other example about the bonding process, and we took that data from a spreadsheet, and I just got a white piece of paper and just roughly drew it out.
Yeah.
And then when we saw the dots, one of the managers goes, oh, wow, we're actually more consistent than I thought. Mm-hmm. Once he saw it visually, he's like, I know. But maybe your process is fairly stable, but it's not capable. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're still at an hour and 15 minutes, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, every time you're doing it 60 minutes, that's fine. We need to get to 30. So now let's go get it capable. It's stable, but it's not great. I would say, you know, anytime we're working on this stuff, Ryan, it's you look at a process, the thing we're combating is variation. So the more variation we have. So the first job is to get your process stable.
Yeah.
Even if the output isn't great, I know I can count on it. Every time I do this process, it's a 20% defect rate. It's always 20% defect. I can plan for it. I understand it. And it's stable. Now I can improve it. Now I can make it capable. Now I need to get it to 1% mm-hmm. defect rate. And now we can start doing the work of changing the process while it's stable and making improvements to get to that excellent level of performance.
And that process is essentially what we were talking about before, or is there more to it?
There's lots of ways to go about it. I'm a fan of the improvement coaching Kata method because it's a fairly, I'll say, easy to understand framework mm-hmm. that creates autonomy for the team to have a voice about what they should do, but they understand what we're striving for and how we're measuring it. And they get to decide what the next steps are. Go take that step. Let's go to work. If we were to approach that with an A3 or a DMAIC or that kind of stuff, it gets a little scary because now we got this form and an 8-step thing, and I'm not sure what you mean by root cause analysis, and I have to follow a programmatic step approach. But that's for advanced problem solvers. If we're engaging a process team, and this is the first time we've talked about problem solving and process improvement, it's an awesome way to get people engaged in thinking about how to improve their process and working together as a team to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did we, excuse my ignorance here, but did we basically cover the steps of that?
Did we cover the steps of the Kata?
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't really hit a lot around the PDCA, the rapid experimentation. But the whole point is once you've identified your key obstacle you're working on,
yeah.
we just set that into a PDCA rapid experimentation method. We just say, what's the next step? Well, if I take that next step, what do I expect to happen? So I'm going to make a prediction about what that step will do. Mm-hmm. Then I go do it. And I come back and say, what actually happened? Mm-hmm. Did we do that step? And did we get the output that we expected from taking that step?
Yep.
And typically an obstacle is going to require maybe dozens of steps to get rid of that obstacle. Once that obstacle is no longer relevant, we eliminated it, we'll go to the next obstacle and keep doing that. The whole point is that we're creating the habit of problem solving, scientific thinking in the world of work every day.
Yeah.
And we're just taking crazy small steps every day. And I think that is far more effective oftentimes than our traditional A3 project management approach. You know, there's so many stories we could tell about engineering manager teams, supervisor teams that get together with an A3 and we have a meeting and we start, and then 2 weeks later we have another meeting, and maybe we've done some work in between and have another meeting. So what are we practicing? We're practicing status quo.
Yeah.
Because all those 2 weeks in between, we're not practicing scientific thinking. We're only maybe doing it when we get everybody in the conference room, which we shouldn't be doing it anywhere there. We should be out where the Gemba is. The Kata creates that environment where I know I'm going to be asked the question tomorrow. Mm-hmm. What's the next step? What did I learn? And where are we now? And that drives really good discipline and accountability for everybody, for the team, the supervisor, and the coach. Coach being the manager.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's it. We unpacked it pretty good.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense to me. I think you can use PDCA cycle in all kinds of different areas of.
Yeah. Even that gets people tripped up. It's like, don't forget about PDCA. Then just what's the next step? And what do you think will happen? Right. What's the experiment or the next step we got to do to get that obstacle out of here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I love about how you explain this is that you kind of demystify and push aside all of the special terms. And it's like, here's what it is. This is what we're trying to accomplish. Don't get too hung up on whether it's, you know, whatever Japanese term that it happens to be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Probably one of the biggest things that people get tripped up on is the word challenge. Because if I come to you and say, hey, what's the challenge here? They'll say, well, the challenge is I don't get the orders on time. The challenge is this machine keeps breaking down. It's like, no. Those are obstacles. Define what this process should do in terms of excellence. Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge we're striving for. So I don't know, change the word. What is our objective?
Yeah.
What are we striving for in terms of excellence for this process? So anyway, I'm happy to change that word up too if that gets people messed up. But yeah. But if we can learn it and create that vocabulary, I think it's cool. I like it. It's like, what's your challenge here? Our challenge is to get this process to 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Awesome. Where are you now? We're here. What's your next target? Here. Mm-hmm. What obstacles did you consider? These ones. Which one are you working on now? What was the next step you took? And that those questions, the leaders show up, hey, I'm learning about what's happening and I'm in tune, but I'm also helping the team work through it by asking the question. Yeah. Good stuff.
It is good stuff. And it flows. And so what I'm getting to is like, this flows all the way through the organization, right?
Amen. Absolutely. Yeah, ultimately, every process team is going to have a problem to solve. I mean, we just say it that way. We have a challenge, you know, and there's a lot of good discussion and literature out there, Brian, around respect for people. And Womack and others would say that the ultimate form of respect is to give people a problem to solve, give them a challenge. And we trust and respect that you're a smart person and we need you to help us solve this problem. You're in charge. I'm going to get behind you and support you. You're not alone. I'm going to coach you along the way, but you own it. Let's go.
Yeah. Makes everybody feel good, right?
Yeah. That's cool, right?
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trusted.
I think so. I'm worthy.
Yeah.
I'm valued here.
That's good stuff.
And I'm getting support and coaching along the way. And how great is it when we actually achieve something close to the challenge and we made a massive improvement in a process?
Yeah.
And we could say, I did it. We did it. The team did this. And that, man, pride and teamwork and the collaboration and the trust and respect that comes as a result of that. Talk about a boost to employee engagement.
You're getting fired up today.
Yeah. Powerful. Oh, man, I'm fired up. Let's go. I want to do one right now.
So we're kind of coming to the end of the hour. And there's a couple sort of questions that I like to ask a lot of people or everybody that comes on the podcast. And one of them is, you know, what's something that you kind of gave one of these. So if you want to use that one, that's fine. Something that you learned as a kid that has stuck with you throughout life.
Yeah. Well, that first of all, be careful how you tease your big brothers because they're bigger and powerful than you. But yeah, that. You know, it was a lot of dang hard work every day in the farm, and I want to find the easiest way to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was learning, you know, just in it, not just me independently, but it was just part of what we did.
Yeah.
And have fun while we do it. It's hard work every day. It's a grind. So, but we can show up with a good attitude and have some fun while we do it. It doesn't need to be that we don't need to, right? Attitude. And if people show up with a good attitude in that work, it's so much more better.
Yeah. It's easier. Yeah.
Yeah. Come on.
For sure. So where do you go to learn new things?
I like to read books. Actually, I like to listen to books on Audible, and then I buy the book so I can go back and take notes because it's like, I want to see that. So that's one. But just a variety of activities in networking and other smart people and asking them for, you know, their experience and knowledge and ways of working. In my role at the bank, it has been a really great experience to apply these things from that I learned in a manufacturing environment to service industry. But the other thing too is like, you know, typically manufacturing companies don't approach problem solving from, you know, customer experience or customer experience design, journey mapping, those kind of things. It's very synonymous with value stream mapping and flowing very greater value to mm-hmm. customer in a manufacturing environment, but there's a different methodology and way of thinking about that design. And that's been a big learning curve for me, and I'm blessed for it. It's another big tool in my belt. And so just putting yourself in environments where you get to learn new different ways of thinking and solving problems is good.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite book that you like, just a favorite book or something you like to recommend for people to read?
I'll make a recommendation. I have lots of favorite books. I couldn't answer. Couldn't pick one. I'll just say this one. This is my friend in Iowa. He's a guy like me named Rick Brimeyer. And this is a fantastic book, not well known. But it's a really cool discussion. It's called Working Great, Lean Leadership Lessons for Guiding mm-hmm. Your Organization to Excellence by Richard Brimeyer. And the way he architected this book is as if you as a lean coach and a leadership team are going on an expedition. In this lean journey, what we say, he calls it an expedition. And each chapter of the book is like 1 month of the expedition. So in January, we're prepping for the expedition. Hmm. In February, we're putting all our stuff together to get ready to go on the expedition. And I just like the way he kind of built, framed the book. And it is almost all about great leadership in this work. I mean, there's plenty of books that teach you how to do value stream mapping and 5S and all the tools and methods. This is heavy on leadership, and it's really, really good.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I'll check that out. That sounds like an interesting way to
approach it.
So how can people get a hold of you if they want?
They can email me. Website coming soon for my consulting practice. And my consulting practice is a super creative name. It's Jesse DePriest Consulting, LLC. and there will be a website coming soon to find me online, but just email me. My email is F as in Francis, J as in Jesse, DePriest@gmail.com. Or find me on LinkedIn.
Easy enough.
LinkedIn's probably a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to me today. I really enjoyed this conversation. I am going to go tackle one of our big problems right after this. You do have me all fired up.
Okay. So, call me if I can help.
All right.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian and Jesse, Zen and the Art of Manufacturing podcast. Get it wherever you can get your podcast: Spotify, Apple, Google, everywhere else.
Everywhere else.
So, Jesse, yep. Have a good weekend.
Yeah. Hey, do you want a dad joke before we go?
Yeah, sure.
Do you know, when does a joke become a dad joke?
I don't know.
When the punchline becomes apparent. There you go, brother. It's been a pleasure.